Okay, so think about this. You've got this massive, incredibly complicated machine you need to keep running smoothly.
Right.
Sometimes it needs more speed, other times you got to tap the brakes, you know, trying to keep it all steady.
Yeah, avoiding the big lurches or worse, a crash.
Exactly. And managing a whole national economy. Well, it's kind of like that. There are these like hidden forces working all the time, trying to influence growth, keep prices in check.
Keep things stable. And the main engineer, if you like, in charge of that fine tuning, that's typically the country's central bank.
Right.
And they use this key set of tools we call monetary policy.
Precisely. And that's exactly what we're diving into today. We're really going deep on monetary policy. It's such a critical piece of how economies are managed globally.
Yeah, and this deep dive, it's based on a really comprehensive set of materials. You've pulled together lots of notes digging into this very topic.
So our mission today, let's try and really unpack monetary policy, not just, you know, the definition, but how it actually works day to day. What levers do central banks pull?
What are the different strategies?
Yes, and crucially, how does it all play out in the real world? Maybe we can even visualize it using models like aggregate demand and aggregate supply.
Definitely. We want you to see the connection between these like high-level decisions in a central bank meeting and things that affect you directly.
Like your mortgage rate, maybe.
Exactly. Or whether companies are hiring, or even just how fast prices are going up in the shops. It's fundamental. By the end of this, you should have a much clearer picture of how this whole system works. So, let's get into it.
Okay, so fundamentally, what is monetary policy actually trying to do? What are the big goals here?
Well, think of it like the central bank has a job description, a mandate, and the material highlights the main objectives. Keeping inflation under control, that's a big one.
Stable prices.
Right. Then promoting full employment, trying to make sure people who want jobs can find them. Also, things like ensuring the currency is stable and fostering sustainable economic growth over the long run.
So it's about building a stable economic environment.
Pretty much, yeah. A solid foundation.
And the main way they try to influence these things, it's about managing money, right? And credit.
Exactly. They're trying to steer something called aggregate demand. That's just the total amount of spending in the economy.
Yeah.
Households, businesses, government, you know, exports minus imports.
Okay.
By making it cheaper or more expensive to borrow money, or by changing how much money is actually out there, they can nudge this total spending up or down.
Gotcha. So it's different from fiscal policy. That's the government with taxes and spending.
Right, that's the other side of the coin. But monetary policy, because it's handled by the central bank, is often seen as, well, maybe a bit more nimble.
Faster to react.
It can be, yeah. Central banks can often adjust interest rates, for example, much faster than governments can pass new budgets or tax laws. So they have this unique role in responding relatively quickly to economic changes.
Okay, so they have these goals, they influence demand. How do they actually do it? What are the tools in the toolkit?
Right, this is where the rubber meets the road, so to speak. The most prominent tool, the one you always hear about in the news, is influencing interest rates.
Yeah, the base rate or the policy rate the central bank sets. But how does changing just one rate affect everything else?
Well, it acts like a bedrock. The central bank usually sets a target for the rate in which commercial banks lend reserves to each other, often overnight.
Okay.
And that rate then ripples out. It influences basically all other interest rates in the economy. Think mortgages, car loans, business borrowing costs, credit cards, even what you earn on your savings.
Ah, so if they lower that base rate.
Borrowing becomes cheaper across the board. Consumers might be more willing to, say, buy a house or a car on credit. Businesses might see a green light for investing in new equipment or expanding.
And the reverse, if they raise rates, borrowing gets pricier, maybe people save more, spend less, businesses hold back on investment.
Exactly that. It hits demand directly through the cost of money. But, you know, the material also notes wider effects it can impact asset prices, like stocks and property.
Makes sense.
And, as we'll probably get to, exchange rates, too. It's a really powerful lever because money touches almost every economic activity.
Okay, so interest rates are key. What about the other big tool mentioned, managing the money supply itself? How do they actually, you know, put more money into the economy or pull it out?
The classic method, still widely used, is something called open market operations, or FOMOs.
FOMOs, right.
Basically, the central bank buys or sells government securities. Think government bonds on the open market. usually dealing with commercial banks.
So if they want more money in the system,
they buy those bonds from the banks.
Okay.
And when they buy them, they pay the banks with newly created central bank money or reserves.
Ah, so cash goes to the banks.
Exactly. This injects liquidity, gives banks more funds available to lend out. More lending potentially means more money circulating in the wider economy.
And to tighten things, take money out.
They do the opposite. They sell bonds to the banks. The banks pay the central bank using their reserves so that money is effectively withdrawn from the banking system. Less money for banks to lend.
It sounds quite straightforward, but I imagine the scale must be huge.
Oh, absolutely. Billions are often involved.
Yeah.
And related to this, we've heard a lot about quantitative easing, QE, especially since the financial crisis. How does that fit in? Is it just bigger FOMOs?
Good question.
It's sort of like FOMOs on steroids, often used when the main interest rate tool is already near zero and can't be cut much further.
Right, when you've hit that floor.
Yeah. So instead of just buying short-term government bonds, the central bank might buy longer-term government bonds or even other types of assets like mortgage-backed securities in some cases.
And the goal is still the same.
Fundamentally, yes. Injecting large amounts of liquidity directly into the financial system. The aim is often to push down longer-term interest rates specifically, trying to encourage lending and investment even when short-term rates are stuck.
So QE is more of an unconventional tool for tougher times.
That's generally how it's been used, yes. The material also briefly mentions a couple of other tools, maybe less common day-to-day now, things like reserve requirements.
That's how much cash banks have to hold.
Exactly, how much they have to keep back against deposits. Changing that ratio affects how much they can lend out. And also influencing credit regulation, directly setting specific rules for lending, like for mortgages.
Okay, so a range of tools. But interest rates and money supply via OMOs or QE seem like the main one.
Definitely the most prominent.
Now, how do central banks decide? When do they use these tools? And do they push the accelerator or the brake? This brings us to those two main stances, right? Expansionary versus contractionary policy.
Exactly. And the choice depends entirely on the state of the economy. Expansionary monetary policy is what they use when things are slow.
Like in a recession or if unemployment is really high?
Precisely. The economy needs a boost.
So the goal is to get things moving again.
That's it. To stimulate activity. So the central bank will typically cut interest rates.
Make borrowing cheaper.
Right. And they might increase the money supply. Maybe through those FOMOs we talked about, buying bonds, making money easier to get hold of.
And what's the intended chain reaction there?
Well, the idea is that cheaper, more available credit encourages households to spend more and businesses to invest more. This increases that overall aggregate demand.
Okay.
Which in turn should encourage businesses to produce more goods and services and hopefully hire more people. So you get lower unemployment and faster economic growth. That's the aim.
But there's always a but, isn't there? A potential downside.
Absolutely. The main risk with expansionary policy is inflation. If you boost demand too much or too quickly, especially if the economy is already running close to full capacity.
Too much money chasing too few goods.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Prices start getting pushed up across the board. So stimulus is good, but overdoing it leads to inflation problems.
Okay. Which leads us neatly to the other side. Contractionary monetary policy. When does that come into play?
That's the toolkit for when the economy is running too hot. Usually the main concern driving this is high or rising inflation.
So expansionary is the gas pedal, contractionary is the brake.
That's a pretty good analogy, yeah. The central bank deliberately tries to slow things down.
How? By doing the opposite.
Exactly. They'll raise interest rates, making borrowing more expensive. They might also decrease the money supply, perhaps by selling bonds through MOMOs, pulling money out of the system.
Making money tighter.
Right. This dampens consumer spending and business investment, cooling down overall economic activity.
And the number one goal here is getting inflation down.
Yes, primarily. By reducing aggregate demand, you ease the pressure that's pushing prices up. But again, there's a trade-off.
The risk here is slowing the economy too much.
That's the potential side effect. Slowing down demand can lead to slower economic growth, and businesses might scale back production or even lay off workers, potentially leading to higher unemployment, at least in the short term.
So it really is this constant balancing act. Trying to keep employment high and growth steady, but also keeping inflation low and stable.
It's exactly that, a very tricky balancing act. And the material you shared actually provides a great way to visualize these effects and the trade-offs using the aggregate demand and aggregate supply model.
Yes, the ADS model. Good old ADS. Remind us how that helps here.
Sure. So the model basically shows the relationship between the overall price level in the economy on one axis and the total quantity of real output, real GDP, on the other. You have the aggregate demand curve sloping downwards,
showing total spending at different price levels.
Right. And the aggregate supply curve showing total production potential, usually upward sloping, at least in the short run.
Okay. So expansionary policy, lower rates, more money. How does that show up on the graph?
Because it stimulates consumption and investment, expansionary policy shifts the aggregate demand curve to the right.
More demand at every price level.
Exactly. It represents an increase in total desired spending across the economy.
And if that AD curve shifts right, what does the model predict happens to output, jobs, and prices?
Well, it depends a bit on where the economy starts on the aggregate supply curve. Mm-hmm. But let's say we're in a situation with some slack, maybe during a downturn. That rightward shift of AD moves the economy's equilibrium point. Real GDP total output increases. That generally means firms need to hire more people, so employment goes up.
Good news so far.
But as demand increases, firms find they can charge more. So the overall price level also tends to rise. The model clearly shows you get more output in jobs, but likely at the cost of some inflationary pressure.
Right. It visually shows that trade-off. More activity, but higher prices. So what about contractionary policy then? Raising rates, tightening money.
That reduces spending and investment. So on the graph, contractionary policy shifts the aggregate demand curve to the left. Less demand at every price level.
Okay. AD shifts left. And the impact.
The new equilibrium point will be at a lower level of real GDP. Less output is being produced.
Which probably means fewer jobs needed.
Often, yes. Employment tends to fall or grow more slowly. But the upside, the intended effect, is that with less demand pressure in the economy, firms are less able or willing to raise prices. So the overall price level falls, or at least rises much more slowly. It helps curb inflation.
So the model really highlights that stark choice again, fight inflation, but potentially at the cost of slower growth and fewer jobs, certainly in the short term.
It does. It's a powerful framework for understanding the intended logic and consequences. But, and this is important, our material also stresses that the real world isn't always quite so neat. The effectiveness can vary.
Ah, so the model is a simplification. It doesn't always work out exactly like that on the graph. What complicates things?
Well, one big factor mentioned is the shape of the aggregate supply curve itself. Imagine the economy is already running flat out near its absolute maximum capacity.
Okay, everyone's working, factoists are busy.
Right. In that scenario, the AS curve becomes very steep, almost vertical. If you then try to stimulate demand further with expansionary policy shifting AD, right, what happens?
If supply can't really increase much more, does it just push prices up a lot?
Exactly. You get a big jump in the price level, lots of inflation, but very little, if any, increase in actual output or employment.
Yeah.
You're just pouring fuel on a fire that's already growing brightly.
Okay, so the effectiveness depends on how much slack there is in the economy. Makes sense. What else?
Another huge real-world issue is time lags. The notes are clear on this.
Mm-hmm.
Monetary policy changes don't happen instantly.
Right. You mentioned that earlier.
It can take months, sometimes, you know, a year, maybe even 18 months or more, for an interest rate change to fully work its way through the system.
How so?
Well, it affects banks' lending decisions. Then businesses have to decide whether to invest based on new rates. Consumers might adjust their spending patterns. All these steps take time before you see the final impact on overall growth, employment, and inflation.
That must make the central bank's job incredibly difficult. They're making decisions now based on forecasts of where the economy might be in a year or more.
It's a major challenge. It's like trying to steer that big ship we talked about, but the rudder only responds after a really long delay. You might overshoot or undershoot your target.
Yeah, I can see that. Any other big challenges?
Yeah, something called the liquidity trap, also discussed in the material.
Liquidity trap. Sounds ominous. What is it?
It's a situation, usually when interest rates are already incredibly low, maybe near zero.
Okay.
Even if the central bank tries more stimulus, maybe cuts rates a tiny bit more,
mm-hmm.
or does massive QE, injecting tons of money, it might have little effect.
Why not?
Because people and businesses might be so pessimistic, so worried about the future. Or maybe they just have enough cash already that they don't want to borrow or invest more, no matter how cheap it is. They just prefer to hold on to the cash, the liquidity.
So the policy lever just stops working.
Essentially, yeah. Monetary policy becomes ineffective at boosting demand. We saw elements of this in several countries after the 2008 global financial crisis. Interest rates were near zero, central banks were pumping in money via QE, but recovery was still very slow because confidence was shattered.
Wow. So the tool itself has limits.
It does. And one final point the material touches on is the importance of credibility and expectations.
You mean whether people believe the central bank?
Exactly. A central bank's success isn't just about mechanics. It's also about psychology. If businesses and workers believe the central bank is serious about controlling inflation and will succeed, they're more likely to act in ways consistent with that maybe moderate wage demands, keep price increases smaller.
And if they don't believe the central bank?
If they expect high inflation to continue, they might demand big wage increases now, or firms might raise prices preemptively. This can create a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, making it much, much harder for the central bank to actually get inflation down. Maintaining public trust and managing expectations is absolutely vital for them.
Wow. Okay. We have certainly covered a lot of ground there. A real deep dive into monetary policy.
Yeah, we really went through its core definition, didn't we? How central banks use it to manage money, interest rates, credit, all aimed at those big macro goals like controlling inflation, keeping the currency stable, aiming for full employment, and supporting growth.
And we looked closely at the key tools in their box, interest rate policy being the main one, but also how they influence the money supply through things like open market operations and sometimes the bigger quantitative easing, plus those knock-on effects on exchange rates and their role in credit regulation.
Mm-hmm. And we made that crucial distinction between the two main stances. Expansionary policy hitting the gas during downturns by lowering rates and boosting money supply.
Right, trying to stimulate things.
Versus contractionary policy tapping the brakes when the economy is overheating, fighting inflation by raising rates and tightening the money supply.
And we use the ADS model to kind of visualize that, seeing how expansionary policy ideally shifts AD, right-boosting output, potentially jobs, but risking prices.
While contractionary shifts AD left, helping curb inflation, but potentially slowing down output and employment. It shows those trade-offs.
Absolutely. And understanding all this, it really does give you, the listener, a much better handle on the economic forces shaping your world, doesn't it?
Totally. Those central bank decisions really do influence job availability, the cost of getting a mortgage or a business loan, and yeah, the prices you pay every day.
For sure. Now, we did touch on some of the, let's say, the messy realities and challenges. Those time lags are a big one.
Yeah, frustrating for policymakers.
Or that idea of a liquidity trap, where the main tool might just stall out. So given these, you know, potential pitfalls and the sheer complexity of it all, maybe a final thought is, how much fine-tuning can central banks really achieve with monetary policy alone?
That's a great question, especially when you factor in everything else going on, government fiscal policy, global shocks, technological changes. How much control do they truly have? And what happens when these monetary tools reach their practical limits? Definitely something to think about.